Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Running for president is running the gauntlet. Interesting term, running the gauntlet. It comes from the act of punishing a warrior by forcing him to strip off his armor and run between parallel rows of soldiers, a gauntlet, who attack him as he passes. So they're literally bipartisans. And what parallels there are to politics, the rules of the gauntlet allow for a ban on edged weapons, which is like candidates picking the moderators for a debate. It allows for requiring the soldiers to keep one foot in place, and that is campaign finance laws. It allows the victim to protect his head with his hands. That's being able to play the blame the media card. This hour, On Point, how we pick the president. And you can join the conversation. Are we picking our presidential candidates the right way? Has the primary season been helpful or just one big sloppy talent show? You can comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me in the studio is Tad Devine, president of the media consulting firm Devine Mulvey. He's worked with Democratic presidential candidates going back to Jimmy Carter, Walter Mondale, and Michael Dukakis. He was the senior advisor in Al Gore's 2000 and John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaigns. He is currently a resident fellow at the Kennedy School of Politics. At Harvard. Tad, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be with you.
Also joining us from the phone from New York is Nicole Wallace. She was communications director for the 2004 Bush-Cheney reelection campaigns. She later served as the White House communication chief during President Bush's second term. She also served as senior advisor for McCain Palin 2008. Most importantly, I think now for her trying to sell books, she's the author of two political thrillers, It's Classified, just out in September. Hello, Nicole.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And these political thrillers are set on the 18 acres of the White House, correct?
That is right, with a woman president.
A woman president.
You have a clue at what I think is missing.
Uh-huh. So, Nicole, you know you have won given these set of rules, and you know that this is the business we have chosen, to quote Hyman Roth. It's a grueling process. Is that actually a strength in terms of how we pick the president, that it is so hard to get through the nomination process?
Yeah, look, at the risk of being ostracized by my own party, which has never really kept me in line anyway, I think that the process is what saves us from ending up with someone who is unfit for office. And I think that we have a closer view of what it does to the human beings. It makes it more excruciating for us as spectators. But I think it is all the more necessary considering the low regard with which the public holds prior government experience. If the public is going to throw out what has traditionally been the high regard it's held prior experience for someone to serve the highest office, then I think it's absolutely essential that the media and the candidate's competitors put them through these kinds of paces. I don't know what else spares us from someone who is ill-equipped for the office.
So, Nicole, and I'll follow up with you, then the great strengths are what? That it is so long, that there is a lot of unfairness to it, because there's going to be unfairness to whoever the president is, that they're made to do so many things, from raise money to appeal to farmers to appeal to financiers. Is all of that to the benefit of the electorate, the process?
Well, I think there's a lot wrong with our process, but I'd still take it over any other country's democratic process, or in many cases undemocratic process. So I don't think we live in a country where our political process or our nominating contest is without deep and disturbing flaws, but I do think that the voters see enough of our candidates to typically get it right.
Ted, what do you think? It has been suggested that if a person wants to run for president, that alone may be something of a disqualifier for allowing a person to run for president. But what about, Nicole, what Nicole is saying, this grueling process, does it ultimately result in rational decisions?
Yes, I agree with Nicole. I think the process is not perfect, but I think it's fair. I think it's a test of whether or not someone can cross the highest threshold in our politics, which is the threshold of presidential credibility. This is an enormous office, and the responsibility that goes with it is great. And to subject yourself to the scrutiny of the public, of the press, and now in a new age, a different kind of scrutiny, the immediate scrutiny of the internet, the Twitter followers who are with you, the people with their phones who can videotape every word and that you utter and post it online in moments. I think that depth of scrutiny really forces presidential candidates to pass a high threshold, and it's the right kind of test, because the threshold for credibility as president is the highest one we have.
So it's like Navy SEAL training. You know, if they could get through that, maybe they could do the job. So let's talk about tweaks at the edges. If we agree that we want something that is long and something that is hard and something that is dramatic, what are the most unfair parts of the process? You know, if I put you as king or as someone with absolute power, Tad, what would you change about it? What do you think is the most at odds with what we're trying to ultimately achieve, which is the best candidate?
Well, I think how much money you have to raise is an enormous obstacle. I mean, the amount of money you need to run for president this day has gone from millions to hundreds of millions, and in this campaign, probably over $1 billion. And raised in a presidential campaign in increments of no more than $2,500 at a time, it takes an awful lot of energy and effort on the part of the presidential candidate and those around him directed towards raising all of that money. So I think if somehow we could get money out of politics, both the influence of it and also the time that is consumed in raising it, I think we'd all benefit from that.
But Nicole, what about this cycle? Because some of the highest polling Republicans, Kaine and Gingrich, haven't been raising much money at all. Is what we're seeing now turning those assumptions on their head?
Yeah, well, I agree with that. And let me just add something to Tad's point. When we ran in campaigns against each other, the Kerry versus Bush campaign, it wasn't the same money that these campaigns have to use against each other now. The money that Tad's side had to work with and our side had to work with was raised, as he suggested, in the maximum of, I think, $2,500 increments, which is a whole lot of money to the vast majority of people, but it's still an individual donation. Campaign finance laws have changed dramatically, and the money that is going to fund the Democratic nominee, the incumbent president, and the eventual Republican nominee is a totally different kind of money. It is not transparent. It is not in increments that are limited to $2,500. And it is, I don't want to use the word corrupted, but it is more opaque to the voter than it was 2 years ago, 4 years ago, and 8 years ago.
Right, so the good old
money,
days.
Yes. Right, the good old days when we just, you know, waged million-dollar campaigns against each other are over. Now, one reassuring data point might be the fact that because of all the primary debates we've had on the Republican side, those debates, which are nationally televised mostly on cable networks, have served as a bit of an equalizer. The best-funded candidates, one of them is Rick Perry. He has been the most deeply and permanently damaged by the debates. So you could make the case that the amount of debates we've had on the Republican side has helped neutralize the effect of the money.
Right. You could also make the case that being president isn't a debate society, and that some of the candidates, Gingrich and Kaine, who I've talked about, have been really good in debates. But is that really the standard by which, or the best standard by which to choose a president? I mean, Rick Perry will argue, look, I'm not the best debater. Doesn't mean I won't be the best president or candidate.
Well, I don't think it's the best. I worked for two presidential candidates in George W. Bush and John McCain and a vice presidential candidate in Sarah Palin, who were the inferior debater to their competitors, and ultimately the first candidate I worked for prevailed and the second did not. But it is one of the only nationally televised events in a primary. So I don't think it's the most important skill to display, but it's one of the only ones that the entire country, the entire electorate has access to.
Well, what do you think, Tad, of these 10 debates we've seen? You, I'm going to guess, won't be voting for anyone who's participating in those debates, but do you think that they've been revealing of character or policy, mostly useful or mostly a sideshow or a waste of time?
Well, I think they've been very useful. And yes, I will not be voting for any of the people on that stage, but I think the voters who are really interested...
You seem like a cane man.
No.
What about that 999 t-shirt you're wearing?
I'm definitely not going down that road. But you know, I think they've been very useful because, first of all, obviously, the voters, particularly on the Republican side at this moment in time, are very interested in finding a candidate to run against the president. And therefore, they're paying close attention to those candidates on stage. And I think the thing that's been remarkable about the Republican process thus far is to see how many people have surged to the front. You know, Bachman did it early. Trump had a brief period. You know, Perry got in the race and dominated it and has fallen. Kane suddenly had this surge. And now it looks like Gingrich is running up to challenge Romney. And I think those Republican voters who either are looking for an alternative to Romney or in some ways are just not happy with having him at the head of the ticket are really going around trying to find it. And I think these debates have served a very important purpose in that voters, I think, see them as unfiltered through the press, as real, genuine, authentic outlets where they can evaluate these candidates.
Even if the moderators are sometimes booed, I think in general that is the case.
It's very different than the stuff I do, making television ads and campaigns. But, you know, but just one point about the money that McCall mentioned, and I think it's true, the debates have given an opportunity for candidates to come forward. But I think in the end, someone like Romney, who has put in place the resources, who has campaigns on the ground in important early states, and who will be able to receive a nomination because he's put in place a mechanism to receive a nomination, that the money in the end is going to probably be decisive.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the presidential season, what's new, what's old, what works and what doesn't, in the way candidates campaign for our votes and the way we choose them. My guests this hour are Nicole Wallace, former advisor and communications director for Bush Cheney in 2004. And for McCain-Palin in 08, author of the new novel about the workings of the White House called It's Classified, and Tad Devine, not a novelist, but a longtime Democratic political consultant. He has worked with Democratic presidential candidates from Jimmy Carter to Walter Mondale to Mike Dukakis, Al Gore, John Kerry. In other words, all of them before the latest. Thanks again for joining us. Let's talk about the character traits we want. Nicole, you have said that we want the president to be a policy expert on the one hand, yet also a totally reliable neighbor and a totally relatable neighbor, a hail fellow well met, yet a guy who knows everything about the world. And in a Time magazine interview, you characterize that dual standard as absurd. So what is a candidate to do?
Well, it's not an absurd aspiration for us as voters, but it's nearly unachievable. And I would place only Bill Clinton and politicians like maybe Tony Blair. I mean, those are the only two modern politicians I would place in that category. And they're truly extraordinary. But I think that we have, as Americans, a very puritanical view. We have an intolerance of infidelity and personal foibles that stands alone in the world. I think that's to our credit, but I also am quite confident it limits the pool of candidates dramatically. And we also build up our politicians in a way that politicians around the world, and particularly in Europe, are not built up during a campaign season. And almost always that sets them up for a dramatic fall that is probably more traumatic for us as a public than it is for the politician, him or herself.
Yeah, maybe it's because the president is head of government and head of state. And in countries with a prime minister and a president or a prime minister and a queen, they could just have the prime minister, the person running the government be the technocrat and the competent guy. But here we want, usually guy, sometimes not, but here we want him to be a hail fellow, well-met, and we want him to have all the responsibilities of state. So these standards, usually, Tad, we blame the media. We blame the media for enforcing these standards. But is it really just the public that kind of wants the president to be everything?
Well, I think the public in America has expectations about what their president should be. I think they bring a sense of what it is to be presidential. to the table when they look at campaigns. I think there are certain values and attributes they want to see in a president. It's important for them that they believe the president is being honest with them. One of President Bush's, I worked against him twice, but one of President Bush's great strengths was that people thought he was saying what he believed. And even if people disagree with you, if they think you're saying what you believe, you score points with
them. I think he almost literally would say that, right? I say what I mean and I mean what I say. And then it was your job to do jujitsu and say, well, how do we counter that? Well, you would portray him as intractable. So he says what he means, but he doesn't, you know, challenge himself to think.
I think what you try to do in those presidential campaigns is you try to figure out where the voters are.
Yeah.
And you try to get into that zone with them. And if you can get into that place with them, then, you know, you can persuade them. In 2004, for example, I think the voters in this country were deeply affected by the events of September 11, 2001. And I think the Bush campaign very smartly played to that and spoke about it and reminded people about that because it played to the president's strength. And I think what we tried to do for John Kerry was to reassure people that he had the strength to protect this country, but he had an agenda that revolved around jobs and healthcare and other issues, which was very different than the president. And, you know, we didn't prevail in that, but I think we fought tooth and nail right to the end.
Right. And I
think to the credit of each campaign, what each man ran on was, you as the public may not agree with me, but here's where I stand. And the public ultimately decided. And I think that our job was made much easier by the fact that the times, I think, demanded extreme clarity. I think the times have quite frankly changed. And I think that some of what was perceived as John Kerry's weaknesses in 2004, his attempt to articulate that he had been, you know, for a war supplemental before he was against it, these things were devastating in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 when things were black and white. And I think that campaign turned on George W. Bush, whatever you think of him, and I'm happy that people think a lot more of him now than they did toward the end of his presidency, because I continue to admire him, and as a boss he was tremendous. He was the most extraordinary person I'd ever worked for, because I saw how hard he tried, and I saw how hard the public and the press was on him. But mm-hmm. that election in 2004 turned on the simple question of, do you want a president about whom you will always know where I stand, and it will be black and white and clear? And at that time, at that moment, on that day that the election was decided, I think George W. Bush spoke with much greater clarity about the urgent, issues and concerns and fears of the country. I don't think that's the case in this coming presidential election. I think that we have entered a very gray area. I think we watch these Occupy Wall Street protests, and most of us feel like we're the 99%. I don't know who the 1% is, but not all of us can leave the jobs that we do have and take to the street. I think things are a lot more fuzzy and gray for people, and it's more of a general angst. So I don't know that certainly the campaigns I was involved in offer a lot of lessons for what's to come in 12 months.
I think every presidential campaign boils down to a very short sentence. I think Bush beat Kerry based on the sentence, I am strong and he is weak. And I think the sentence for this presidential campaign will be, I have answers and he doesn't. And whoever convinces the voters of that, who's going to win?
Yeah, you know, I think I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's right. And I think one of the reasons that Herman Cain, for example, has succeeded, he may be falling now, but certainly succeeded, was not so much that he was so clever on his feet and witty, but because he stood up and said, listen, I've got a plan.
It's tangible.
It's called 999. Here's the plan. And this is what it is. And I think people are so desperate right now to see a plan and some hope towards the future that they gravitated towards it in large numbers.
Right. And maybe that explains some of Gingrich. I mean, the old line about Gingrich, that there's a big file cabinet saying these are Gingrich's ideas and a much smaller file cabinet saying these are Gingrich's good ideas. Fine. That's the knock. But the reality is he's offering a lot of ideas. He seems to know what he's talking about. In that category of people who know what they're talking about is Ken Walsh. He is the chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He has written 5 books on the presidency, most recently Family of Freedom, Presidents and African Americans in the White House. Hello, Ken Walsh.
Hi, Mike. Nice to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us. My question to you is about the office of the presidency. It has been noted that we do not choose the presidency like we choose other candidates. Sometimes we'll elect a candidate for a lower office on the principle of he's a crook, but he's our crook. I live in New York City, as does Nicole, and I don't think Mayor Bloomberg is popular, but he has high approval ratings because he's seen as a capable technocrat. Historically, we have not elected the president who just fits that mold and that mold only. Do you think that's fair and proper?
Yeah, well, it's interesting what's happened. I've covered the White House since 86. That's more than 25 years now, and covered campaigns since 1980. And I think something important happened during the Bill Clinton presidency, which is he managed to persuade the country to separate the analysis of character from public leadership. I think there had been sort of a conflation of those two ideas for a long time. But Bill Clinton, because of the impeachment and because of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, managed to persuade people that even if you have a flawed character, even if your morality, personal morality might be subject to criticism, you can still be a good president. And I think by the end of his time in office, people had pretty much recognized that. So I think that's one point. But I think people still think character is very important, and I think you're going to see that manifested in the scrutiny that Newt Gingrich is about to get. You know, Gingrich, of course, has had a messy personal situation with his three marriages and with infidelities and so on, including an infidelity while he was pursuing the impeachment against Clinton for perjury and infidelity. But I think Gingrich is going to test this proposition again, the idea of character versus public policy. As you and Tad and Nicole have said, people want to see these policies. They want us to have solutions. But at the same time, I don't think we've gotten past the point that people want somebody who shares their values. Maybe that's the best way to put it. And I think that Gingrich is going to have a test in this regard, particularly in the context of the Republican caucuses and primaries. And in so many states, the evangelical Christians, the Christian conservatives are very important. So this is going to be an important test coming up here. But I do think Americans still would like their president to share their values. But other things are more important this particular cycle, such as how to create jobs. And I think that's the main policy issue at stake.
Nicole, we talk of the importance of character, but hasn't that word changed over the years since you've been doing your job?
I don't know. I mean, I think that we are watching Herman Cain, and I think we're about to, as Ken suggests, watch Newt Gingrich go through the more classic and traditional character tests. And I think that it's with our heads that we hope and wish that we will select someone who can accomplish a single mission, such as jumpstart our economy, but it's with our hearts that we vote. And I think as Republicans, we are almost incapable of separating the desire to have a nominee and a president that represents what we see as the character of this country. And for the Republican Party, a lot of the Republican Party, that is completely intertwined with family values and a social conservative agenda. And I think it comes from a good and decent place, but it sometimes results in, picking someone who may not be the best person to deal with the most important issue to the most Americans, which is this economy.
Tad, we speak of character. It's been suggested by Ken here that perhaps Newt Gingrich's day of reckoning has come as we reexamine his character. And yet, Herman Cain went through all these charges, which seemed to go directly at his character, untoward behavior towards women, which he did not, at least we can say, offer a consistent explanation for. Yet he didn't seem hurt by that.
Well, I think his surge has clearly stopped, and I think that there's some evidence in some of the polling that, you know, the momentum that he has abated, and even in some polls that he's fallen. So I think Ken is absolutely right. The spotlight of scrutiny is about to come on Gingrich. That's what happens in this process. When you move to the front, the spotlight turns on you. I think he's going to be subjected to some very serious tests. And in the end, you know, running for president isn't just about winning a debate or two or, you know, even raising more money in a quarter than somebody else. It's about putting together a national effort that allows you to go from beginning to end. And I think so far, my observation is on the Republican side, the only one who's done that is Romney, and that's probably why he's going to win.
Let's go to a call. Well, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the structure of who gets to vote when. And Jesse is calling from Sigourney, Iowa. The answer is they vote first. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
I'm calling from Iowa. We take very serious our first in the nation status, and I am a Republican. I just wanted to say that what a lot of you have been saying is we do take character and principleship very serious, but we also take very serious their what they stand for and what their policies are. However, I want to say that every single one of the Republican candidates so far, you know, I think a lot of them have both of those things, and as each one of them surges, both Republicans and Democrats have really tried to take every single one of those people down just simply because they know that that's what's important to us, and I think Republicans are just as guilty. I think a lot of the Republicans want Romney as our candidate,
mm-hmm.
and I think Obama wants Romney as our candidate because it's essentially the same guy, one's white and one's black. And who are you going to vote for? Why save all that or waste all that money on just changing the letterhead?
And who do you like?
I like Perry. Honestly, I've seen all of the presidential candidates in person. I really take serious. I'm a chairperson for my county that I live in. I've really taken it serious, and he seems to be kind of the old Ronald Reagan type, and that's what I'm looking for. Even though I don't agree with everything he says, at least I believe what he says, and it's not all polished. And I don't care about being polished. I just care about being a decent person who can work towards what they say they're going to do.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jesse. Ken Walsh, how about that? You know, Jesse there is intimating that what's broken here is Washington. He likes Rick Perry. He's not in the same mold. He's something different. Is that going to be a very important part in this election? Should that be a very important part in how we pick the president?
Well, a couple points. One is that it's been said for a long time in looking at our politics, our presidential politics, that governors do the best.
Yes.
Because they have the opportunity to show that they can govern on a state level and they know politics, but they're not part of Washington. So, you know, that would, in this case, it should be the advantage of Rick Perry. But if you look at our recent history, sort of President Bush, the son was a governor, Bill Clinton was a governor, Ronald Reagan was a governor, it goes back. You had some differences there. President Obama, of course, was a senator. But I think the reason people like governors is they are experienced in governing, but they're not of Washington. And so, but I think you do see manifest again, as we see so often in our campaigns, this notion of Washington is broken. Somebody's got to fix it. And I think that also opens up in this next cycle this whole notion of sort of a third party independent candidacy opportunity. Ron Paul has done this before as a libertarian. He's made sort of different sounds about whether he might do it again. But it looks to me like there's an opportunity here for an ultimate anti-Washington person, like maybe another Ross Perot. It's just that we don't know who would step into that vacuum. But I do think it's there. And
yeah,
it's a question, not that that person could win, but that person could draw a lot of votes away. And if it's a person from the right, as seems more likely, that would be somebody that could hurt the Republican nominee.
Well, Nicole, you worked closely with a governor. Sarah Palin was a governor, and you concluded that there were serious problems with her qualifications to the point where I've read in interviews that you have said that, you know, as you were prepping her for the debates, there was an internal debate of whether she should actually, should the day come, be sworn in as vice president. Did that call into question the whole primacy of being a governor as a qualification in your mind?
I think she is one of one, and I would never cast that kind of aspersion on all of our nation's governors. I worked for two great governors before that. I worked for the great governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, who would make an outstanding chief executive should he ever run, and I worked for George W. Bush, for whom I've already expressed my affection and admiration. But I do think on Rick Perry. Rick Perry has done an incredible disservice to his own supporters by doing these two things, by entering late and not being ready when he did so. If Rick Perry had the amount of knowledge that he has right now, he should have gotten into the race at a point that was early enough for him to be forgiven for the gaffe.
This is On Point. I'm Mike Peskin for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how candidates get our attention, about who makes it and who flames out, and about how well voters and the media are judging the candidates. My guests this hour are Nicole Wallace, former Republican operative and author of the new novel, It's Classified, longtime Democratic political consultant Tad Devine, and Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Before we went to break, we were talking about Rick Perry. What happened, I guess, is the shorthand version of the question. Remember before he entered the race? Remember how anticipated it was? Here on ABC, analyst Matthew Dowd talking about Rick Perry about to enter the race.
The thing that he brings to the field is a combination of assets that no other candidate seems to have right now. He not only has the passion of a lot of the conservative voters, he speaks both to the economic conservatives and to the social conservatives, and he has 10 years as governor, which gives him a tremendous amount of credibility.
Ken Walsh, what happened to the promise of Perry?
Well, pretty much a flash and fade here, wasn't it? I think that people, as we've been saying, the Republicans are looking for somebody sort of the un-Romney, somebody who's an authentic conservative who combines this likability. We haven't talked about that very much, mm-hmm. but likability is another important trait that people want in their presence, because the presidents are in our living rooms and on our televisions so often that we want somebody we like in that office. But I think with Perry, as Nicole said, he did not seem to be prepared. I mean, anybody can have a brain freeze, but when you forget one of the three departments of government that you want to abolish, that's a pretty serious lapse. But I think what the larger point is here with Perry and a lot of these other candidates is that our process is such and the debates are such that there's almost 100% chance that the flaws or weaknesses of the candidates are going to be brought out by this process. And I think that's a good thing. And with Perry, you saw the idea that he wasn't prepared. He really has not studied the issues, apparently, as not enough as he should. And I think that's been very, very damaging to him. And what Matthew Dowd was saying was sort of such a contrast to how the perceptions of Perry have changed because he's participated in these debates. And the debates have been the fundamental pillar of this campaign so far. We haven't gotten to the much television advertising or policy speeches, although some of that has gone on. It's really the debates that have been the be-all and end-all, a lot of free time for the candidates. And in that contest, Perry has done very badly.
I wanted to ask about the kind of candidate that Perry is. There are a lot of trajectories in political life. There's the guy who comes out of nowhere, Howard Dean, and then doesn't get the job done. There's the guy who we thought was the presumptive nominee and actually does, you know, the first George Bush, actually attains the presidency. But I put Perry in a category, perhaps unfairly, but with Fred Thompson or Wesley Clark, a candidate, a man on a white horse who is supposed to come in and do all these wonderful things because of their track record, because of the quality they brought to the table. I remember Michael Moore, the filmmaker, saying, can you imagine how Wesley Clark will do in the debates and how he'll wipe the floor with George W. Bush? It never came close to that. And here's my question to you, Tad Devine. Perhaps failure has 1,000 different explanations and each one flamed out for different reasons. And also, who knows? Perry could certainly make a comeback. But my question is, were we wrong collectively, the people who set expectations? Were we wrong about Perry? Did we miss something about him?
No, I think, you know, what Matt said at the time he said it was, listen, this guy's got a combination of assets. He was talking about the, you know, being a governor of a big state, all the money he could raise, his ability to communicate, the fact he's run tough campaigns and had good people around him who were ready to run that kind of campaign for president. But the combination of assets meant the reality of scrutiny. And the one thing that Governor Perry really didn't get as a Republican governor in Texas who succeeded to that job in the first place because Governor Bush became president and then was reelected because he could run tough, mean, hard campaigns with a lot of money was when you step on the stage of a presidential campaign in America, the scrutiny is intense. And he obviously wasn't prepared, I agree with Nicole, to step into that arena. He wasn't prepared certainly for the debate format, which you know, put him under a light which was very unfavorable. He began to make mistakes. Those mistakes are picked up and run in the media. And he's fallen from grace in many ways because the expectations for him was so high. And he failed to satisfy his own expectations.
That's true. But Nicole, I mean, I'm reading this. I read this article before Perry entered the race in Texas Monthly by Paul Burka, who's a really good journalist. And he was sort of setting the nation straight on what a qualified candidate Perry was, writing things like, the Texas politician he most resembles is LBJ. Well, that to me translates to cunning and competent. Perry is a hard man. He is the kind of politician who would rather be feared than loved or respected. Well, you know, his gaffe, his post-gaffe Letterman appearances mean that he's forced to ask for our sympathy rather than demand our fear. Were we somewhat wrong about Perry, or is it all what we've been saying so far, that had he prepared differently, he could have been the candidate we thought he'd be?
I think had he entered the contest at a different point, he could have been the nominee. I think Perry's central problem is that, I mean, Tad and I have both worked for candidates, and Ken has covered both of us while doing so, who made mistakes. George W. Bush, in his first debate against John Kerry, delivered a dismal performance. But after that performance, our poll numbers plunged. We regrouped. We watched the coverage. Our candidate understood the gravity of the mistake he'd made, and he didn't make it again. Perry's central problem, along with getting into the contest at a point when he should have known that the lights would be bright and hot, he better be ready, is that he hasn't learned from any of the gaffes. He didn't go back after suggesting that our Fed chairman was had committed treason and rein in comments like that. And I respect voters who are still drawn to him, because I do think there's a very real person underneath. And that's what makes him so heartbreaking for Republicans that had hoped he would have done better. He had loads of potential. He is in many ways the most frustrating candidate on the Republican side, because he you know, Matt Dowd is one of the smartest people on our side, and I don't know if he describes himself as squarely on our side anymore, but he was absolutely right. Rick Perry had everything going for him, but by getting it at a point when the lights were already burning hot and bright, and by refusing to use any of the mistakes as teachable moments to pull back, to regroup, I think he's really disappointed his supporters more than anyone else.
Wow. So maybe the comparison isn't to Thompson or Wesley Clark. It's to Philip II of Spain, had it all and let it slip through his fingers. Now let's talk about Sarah Palin, because your dynamic with her is fascinating. I sense that there was a lot of honesty coming from you and coming from her in describing the other one. What did you... Well, give our listeners a sense of what you came to conclude about Sarah Palin, and what insight did it give you into elections?
You know, I've written two novels about a fictional female president, and I did so because at the end of 15 years in politics, most of them great, I came out of 2008 feeling like, you know, my head had been shoved down a garbage disposal. I mean, I felt like women... candidates, women in the public eye, from Hillary Clinton to Michelle Obama to Sarah Palin, had been brutalized. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter if you loved or hated Hillary Clinton. It didn't matter if you loved or hated Sarah Palin. I did not meet anyone who didn't have an opinion about how they'd been treated by the press and by their own voters and by the other party's voters. So my experience with Sarah Palin is at this point sort of muddled up with my impressions of Hillary Clinton's experience and to a lesser extent, First Lady Obama's experience. And what I concluded was that while we tried to have a pretty thoughtful conversation about race in 2008, and we succeeded some days and we failed others, we have never attempted as a country to have a particularly enlightened or thoughtful conversation about women in the public eye. And again, whatever you think, it is certainly legitimate to feel skeptical that Sarah Palin was up to the job of the vice presidency, particularly in light of the Cheney vice presidency, where it is now widely known that he was granted the authority, if he needed it, to shoot down a passenger jet on 9/11. These are huge responsibilities that we lay in the office of the vice presidency in the modern executive branch. And, I didn't think at the time, and I don't think now, that she was up to the job. But I still was left feeling traumatized, if you will, by her treatment, by the establishment and by the media and the scrutiny applied to her and her family.
And your fictional character, Tara Myers, is that her name? You get to play out a lot of these feelings via her, right?
And that's exactly right. And I'm so glad that's how you described it. This was emotional baggage that I played with on the pages of fiction. And I think some people in Washington got confused that there was some kind of non-fictional narrative hidden in there. And it was really just my impressions of what it's like for women in politics. And having spent almost 8 years in the Bush White House and never ending up in the crosshairs of any candidate I worked for or the media, to suddenly be thrust into every scandal that befell Sarah Palin was just, at the time, shocking for me, but I think in hindsight, it was a very humbling and beneficial experience.
Right, and I certainly appreciate the subtleness of mind that you have expressed, even though that wasn't what we were looking for in 2004 for a presidential candidate. But my blunt question to you is, you came to conclude that Sarah Palin was not qualified. As you look at the Republican field, your own party, do you come to that conclusion with any of the candidates?
Well, I mean, I'm more focused on the people who I think are best qualified, and I think that's just, you know, Mitt Romney is the person that has stood there now for months and, to me, screams loud and clear that he's up for the job. I think he was probably up for it 4 years ago, and I find it incredibly detrimental that my party has continued to lust after all of these candidates who have no interest in running for president for all the reasons we've been talking about all hour. The desire to run is the central qualification for the ability
to serve. So lusting at, you mean like lusting after a Chris Christie, but...
Oh, it hasn't stopped from Chris Christie to Paul Ryan to Sarah Palin. All these people who weren't interested in getting in the arena have garnered more affection and admiration than the guys actually doing the hard work. So I'm a big fan of Governor Romney's candidacy, his qualifications, and the way he's conducted himself as a candidate who hasn't always, I think, been treated with the respect he deserves by my party.
And I see why you're great at debate prep, because you took my question of who is disqualified and turned it into a positive, who is best qualified. So I'm going to ask it again, but I'll give you the out. Is there anyone who's disqualified, but if you want to say that you have no question that whoever is disqualified will not be voted in by the voters? That's how much faith you have in the process. I'll let you say that one.
Well, I'd like to have that much faith in the process. I don't think any of the rest of them have proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they are qualified to be the commander-in-chief yet. That's, you know, no one has cast a single vote yet, so I think they still have time to do so. But to me, Romney's the only one who has proven beyond any reasonable doubt that he could assume the oath of the presidency and be up for the job and do it competently in a way that the times require. So in my view, he's the only one that's proven that he's ready and qualified at this moment.
Got it. Okay, we've been talking about the Republicans who will run against the Democrat in office. Keith is calling from Hartsville, South Carolina. And Keith, you want to bust us out of this mindset, right?
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Yeah, thank you. I really think our two-party system is polarizing and really very crippling. I think there are a lot of even candidates in this race that would maybe like to be off of the party lines. They'd maybe like to be more moderate in the middle. And I think the American public wants to see some more moderate solutions. Not everyone is on one extreme or the other.
All right, Keith, let's put it to the panel. Ken Walsh, this comes up all the time. Is it plausible, a third party?
Well, I think it's plausible. I think it's if we could find the individual who would do this, and as I mentioned earlier, I think that that's really what sort of stalled this process. There is a group out there that's trying to get a slot for a third party or an independent candidate on the ballot so that in state after state, so that if somebody decides to do this who's credible, that person can sort of drop into those slots in the states and qualify for the ballot. So, again, the system, the framework is there, and the political dynamic is there for a third party. And, you know, as I said before, Ron Paul has done this before as a libertarian, conceivably could do it again. But basically, it would help if the third party candidate could drop $100 million of his or her own money into the campaign, and that limits the field pretty dramatically.
Ted Devine, I think political scientists talk about the nature of our system, how it is what's called first past the post. In other words, winner take all politics. Very hard for third parties to succeed. But what about the notion that, I mean, when we talk about third party, we want a more liberal Republican or a more conservative Democrat? Usually, you know, there are those who say that Mitt Romney kind of fits that mold. John Huntsman probably does too, but he doesn't. He's not polling very well. Is this some sort of the strength of Romney? Is that sort of capitalizing on the third party sentiment that you heard the caller express?
Well, I think Ken's right, and I think there is room for another ticket to move forward that this group called Americans Elect, and the process that they're going through, it's very well funded. They are systematically putting candidates on the ballot. They've attained over 2 million signatures already in the course of that process. And I think it will provide a platform for someone to step into it. Whether or not they'll find the right people, I mean, that's the big if. And can someone who could withstand the scrutiny? You know, when Sarah Palin, who I agree with Nicole, was really not ready and not qualified to be president, stepped onto that stage, though, when John McCain picked her and gave, I think, a very remarkable speech, she looked and appeared at the time as someone who could handle that scrutiny and may well be a star in the political process. Now, as the scrutiny intensified, she wilted and wasn't able to handle it. But if someone does come onto that stage, elevated by being picked through an internet process, and survives that scrutiny and is able to, for example, attain a place in the debates, well, then I think that candidate and ticket could be very popular at a time when there's so much dissatisfaction being expressed by the American people about their present and future.
And, Nicole, my final question to you, and you have about 30 seconds. You've spoken highly of Mitt Romney. What of the notion that Mitt Romney is everyone's second choice? Do you think the Republicans are just going to get used to it and past it?
I'll go back to my favorite dating analogy. I mean, often it's the guy that was standing right before you the whole time that you end up with, and lots of people live happily ever after.
That's how rom-coms always work, right?
I think my party needs to just get over it and get behind the guy that's proven himself to be steady, strong, clear, and perfectly equipped to take on Barack Obama.
I don't know if I'm ready to go for the steady, strong, clear. I mean, John Huntsman just called him a perfectly lubricated weather vane, okay? That's from Huntsman. So I think Romney's got to – listen, the scrutiny's going to come on Romney if he survives the process, and it's going to be tough.
And Mormon-on-Mormon crime is always the hardest to take. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us at Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests have been Democratic political consultant Tad Devine, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and Nicole Wallace, communications director for the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign and author of, I think it's going to be a series of books about a female president. What's the newest one called, Nicole?
It's Classified.
It's Classified. Thank you to all my guests. I am Mike Pesca in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.